Good evening. My name is Peter Berg, and I'm head of special collections here in the MSU libraries. I'd like to welcome you to another evening of the Michigan Writer Series. We have up here at front the calendar of the Writer Series for this winter semester. We have one reading following this evening's reading. It'll be by Jim Daniels, who was a poet, a fine poet, a Michigan native, and now writer in residence at Carnegie Mellon University. So he'll be visiting East Lansing April 14th, and I hope you'll be able to come to that as well. Tonight, I'm very pleased to welcome Catherine Fishburne, who is professor of English here at Michigan State University. I asked Catherine to share with me some biographical information about herself, and she wrote the following. I'd like to share it with you. Catherine writes, "In one way or another, I have always been a poet, in the way I see the world and in the way I write about it. From both my parents, I learned early the habits of words. I learned to look up their meaning, follow the path of their usage, revel in their sound and construction. The unabridged dictionary has been a part of my life for as long as I can remember. One might even say it elevated my thoughts. For not only did my family consult it regularly, we also use it as a booster chair to help young children reach their dinner. From both my parents, but most particularly my father, I learned the art of seeing nature. Comets in their orbits, spiders at their webs, beetles in their astounding numbers, weighing in at 250,000 species, birds in residence and in migration. Nothing was too small or insignificant to examine for hours on end. Everything must be accounted for, identified, researched, and understood. Only then could I say that I had truly seen an assassin bug, a garter snake, a snapping turtle. From my mother, herself an English teacher, I learned to hear the poets sing and note their patterns. Be they from Chaucer, Shakespeare, or Tennyson, the poets' words thundered and echoed throughout my childhood, and in conjunction with my father's scientific training, helped to shape my relationship with the world. Be it the relationship I have had with canines, amphibians, arthropods, or humans. The Dead Are So Disappointing is my first collection of poetry. I have recently completed my second, The Resurrection of Kore, and currently I'm on leave, completing my third, The Language of Pain. I will be reading selections from all three collections tonight. Will you please join me in welcoming Catherine Fishburne?
I feel as though I have a quorum tonight. Should probably try and get something passed in my favor. Well, sorry, Michigan runny nose. I'm going to read first of all from The Language of Pain, then I'm going to read from The Dead Are So Disappointing, and then we're going to end with Resurrection. Nice pattern for the season, I thought. The collection on pain that I'm working on right now, I think it's finished, but I keep tinkering with it, is a collection that I have written in response to the problem that we face as human beings when we have pain, and that is trying to make it real to other people. It's real to us, but we find it very hard to find the words to make it real to someone else. So the first poem in the collection sets up this problem, and the subsequent poems in the collection respond to it. And each poem has the same title. It's called Pain. But to distinguish among them, each carries a cardinal number. So I'll read the word pain and then the number, and very often pain is the first word of the line, although it's not repeated. Pain. The experts tell us, beats our words into plowshares until they're no longer weapons ready to hand, but signs pointing nowhere, absent of meaning. Pain, they further explain, can't be shared, being a singular experience no one else understands, condemning our bodies to mute isolation as long as the sentence demands. Of course, the derivation of the word pain comes from punishment or penal, so there's a pun in the sentence. Pain four. Lands sudden and certain like a bright feathered hook in the lip of a well-traveled steelhead. A barb that works itself deeper inside the more the catch tries to wrest it away. Until for all of the stress his contortions have put on the line, as the afternoon bleeds out the ends of the spectrum, the taste of pickerel reed and sweet water blends with that of fine, unyielding metal. And the trout knows that there's no going back to a time when he didn't give it a thought if he had reached his limit or not. For what has caught him is thought without limit, moving and breathing, muscle and tendon, sinus and bone, the fiber of being, and without it, he's nothing. That's for you, Dan. Pain 11 carves out her heart like a wedding guest wielding a silver dessert spoon, deftly scoops out the ripe flesh of a melon, a single curled slice at a time, until nothing remains on the smooth, translucent plate but the rough netted rind of the fruit, lined with the pale green sheen of regret. Pain 14. You can laugh anytime you want to. Pain 14 provides the permanent record of our lives, inscribed in the knees that have bent and spent too much time on the floor, scrubbing the black marks of the soul, till they rise with the baptismal sponge and are plunged into a bucket of water, where they are cleansed without healing. There are puns all through these poems, so if you think there's a pun, you're right. This next poem, Pain 16, takes advantage of the root meaning of courage, which has to do with the heart. Pain 16 bleeds into the spirit like wine spilled on stretched linen, stains not just the verges, but the courage of cloth. This is one of my particular favorites. Where do poems come from? Well, they come from everywhere. In many respects, all of my poems are what they call found poems. You just have to keep your eyes open for them. Several years ago, I had a star cactus. I don't know whether any of you are familiar with that or not, but it's a rather elegant-looking faux cactus. It's really just a succulent. It's not a real cactus. It's got really fuzzy stems. And it gets this beautiful 5-pointed star blossom. Unfortunately, it comes at a price. Pain 21. In its effect surpasses that of the carrion flower, whose pale yellow bud swells in the shimmering heat like a carmine-ringed abscess on the soft-fleshed arms of an otherwise inconspicuous African succulent, until it bursts open with the perfectly symmetrical stench of decay, an odor so loathsome that all but the saints and the blowflies stay away. I got home, and I didn't know it had bloomed. And I thought, my God, what is that horrible odor? I was sure something had died in the house. And I looked everywhere. I was tearing things out of the closet, you know, looking under the bed. It was a really cheap apartment, and there were the garbage containers right outside the bedroom, and there were all these flies on the window, you know, so, oh, there's something in there, so I'm opening the window to look for it. It took me an hour before I discovered it was this gorgeous flower. Pain 42 is a book that, having picked up, I just can't put down. Although it's not very well written, with its predictable plot, lack of description, and unpleasant details, I'd rather forget. but it's captured my full attention, compelled me to carry it around like an unborn child wherever I'm bound. Although it's heavy as the Dickens, and hardly the diversion I first sought when I got it. I wouldn't mind loaning it to anyone. In a weak moment, even a friend. Although I haven't come close to the end, suddenly nobody I know has any interest in fiction. Isn't that the truth? I don't want to hear about your pain. I want to tell you about mine. One of the things that I've tried to do in here, besides represent different kinds of pain and how it feels when it arrives, is to represent different cultural attitudes towards pain. So I'm going to actually read three poems that are together, 44, 45, and 46. All these poems are meant to speak to one another. They're kind of a montage. It's really, I think, quite an elegant collection. There are 61 poems and a whole slew of what I call strange poems. And among the strange poems are three visual homages to 20th century painters who grappled with the notion of pain in their own way. And I used my drawing toolbar on my Microsoft Word. And then I interspersed the drawing with various words and symbols. So this is, like all of my books of poetry, it's a collection of individual poems meant to stand on their own, but it also is a collection where all the poems speak to one another. So I think these three particularly speak to one another because of the different cultural attitudes expressed in them. Again, where do poems come from? Well, Pain 44 was inspired by a book I read this semester called King Leopold's Ghost, which was about the King of Belgium, who owned the Belgian Congo. You know, I mean, that was just a front. The king owned all of it, and the details come from that book. The second poem, Pain 45, comes from Barbara Kingsolver's The Poisonwood Bible, a detail I got there. And Pain 46 actually comes from a jury trial I sat on last summer. That's one I'm particularly proud of, actually. How many people can find a poem in a doctor's deposition at a trial? When I was first called to jury duty, I had the same reaction as everyone does. You know, why me? You know, God, is this random? And I got down there, and of course I was called, and you know, I thought, oh, they won't want me because they don't like people who have a lot of education. And they didn't seem to care that I had a lot of education, so that one failed me. And had I ever had a traffic accident? And well, no, I never got a ticket, so I could sit on it. And then I found out it had to do with pain, and I said, yes! So, keep your eyes and ears open for those poems, folks. Pain 44. Bring me a hand, the district commissioner ordered his agents. The right hand of any man who resists his majesty's injunctions and sows insurrection. The wood that weeps must be tapped to the fullest and quotas met by the deadline that presses upon us, no matter the cost to the workers. Take hostages, if you must, of wives and the children. We've found it an expedient technique. But whatever exigencies face you, remember the two cardinal rules of the colony. The vines must never be killed, nor any bullets wasted on animals other than human. You are to keep exact records of the cartridges expended, and as proof of your accounting, send us the right hand of any native you use to instruct the others on the fate that await those who refuse to die nobly from fatigue or disease in the king's service. Back home, vast monuments wait, their erection in the name of His Highness. and cavernous closets stay to be filled with gowns for his young mistress. So do your job, men, and rest easy. Each day smooths the way for the next. Trust me, you'll get used to dealing with savages. The savages get to speak. Pain 45. Strengthens the bonds we have with each other and with our people's ancestral spirits. Bonds that secure our place in the world, even as they confound the half-body ghosts in the jungle, who would land on our back with their talons and call out our name as their own. When we are summoned to the ancient ritual of cutting by our elders, we must respond joyfully, proud in the knowledge that we who were born in the year of the flood have now earned the right to renounce the pleasures of childhood so that we might become one with the tribe. Our manhood and valor displayed in the closely laid pattern of cables that the priests have contrived on the finely wrought plane of our ebony faces. An intricate meshwork that even the narrow green mamba who hangs in the trees like an unripened fruit cannot slip through. Or angry, book-toting strangers in the name of salvation undo. And what does pain mean to us? A lawsuit. So here we have a lawyer deposing a doctor. In absentia, of course, the doctor being too busy to be there for the trial. This is not exactly verbatim, but it sure is close. Once again, doctor, I must ask your indulgence. What problems did the patient present when she was referred to you? Depressiveness, sleeplessness, tingling and weakness in her left hand and arm, consistent with a C8T1 radiculopathy, which I diagnosed. Pain in shoulder and neck. The depression is part of her history. Am I not right, as is the sleeplessness? That is correct. And the tingling and weakness are part of the history too. Correct, but as I just stated, consistent with C8T1 radiculopathy. Would this show up on any objective tests done on her tissue? Only on an EMG, as I've already stated. But there is no test to determine just what event caused the injury. No, that is correct. Nor any test to detect or quantify the pain. That is correct. Doctor, one last question. Is pain objective or subjective? Subjective, but... Thank you, doctor. Your Honor, I'm through with this witness. This poem, Pain 52, is a kind of lead-in to my collection, The Dead Are So Disappointing. Unhinges your mind from its moorings, leaving it adrift to wander untended in marshes and heaths where the bog people dwell. Leathery and misshapen faces grin through the gases and fog, leering and chasing like lust-maddened youth in search of a calf or a sow. Wailings awake you out of your dreams. Relatives come running, alarmed by your screams and your bed's disarray. Sheets winding around your arms and your head, fists knotted in fear of the demon who sought you in your place of refuge, whom you fought off with a thrust of your legs, breaking one in the process as you lunged through the bars of old age. The dead are so disappointing, leaving us here in the present to work out on our own the problem of anger and dread we feel at their passing. Though some have convinced themselves, or so they aver, that dying is life's last great adventure, to be embraced like scaling a mountain, cresting the rapids, or mapping a wilderness, I personally, given the chance, would gladly pass on the experience. No, he was not afraid, he answered when asked, in a rare moment of personal confession. No point to it, really, since he wouldn't be there, if you considered it. But as it turned out, it wasn't exactly a light switch as he completed the circuit, but more like a rheostat, as daily there was less of him and more of the corpse we carry within. For days, the man he had been resisted the inert body he would become, till finally the blue of necrosis signaled the battle was done, and with one barely detectable exhalation, he gave himself up to the unknown. Yet he gave me no help, this man who always knew everything, in preparing myself for my own fleshy extinction. For if, as he claimed, there was nothing to fear, why then did he fight so hard at the end? A son herself. My father's parting gift, which my mother dutifully passed on, was to announce that he always wished he had had a son. To which my sister and I both responded as though in unison, I thought I was the son. As firstborn, I took his profession with a twist. Each book offered as evidence I was worthy. I tried very hard to be good, but the voice that sits in judgment is that of my father and has yet to be pleased. A friend of my father's informs us that the only time he ever heard my father brag was when he spoke of his grandson. Not being a son herself, my sister, recognizing the value, instead produced one. I'm not crying. The professor's daughter. In truth, there was a lot to mourn in the passing of this man, my father. It isn't only orphans who would envy me his parenting. But in the testimonials others have brought forward, I hear a man I did not know. How can it be that he taught another how to be a good father to his sons when I felt his neglect so soon? Why didn't it last, that which had begun so well? I think I was 4 when I fell in the river, and when I saw the nest of baby snakes, I cannot recall. I also fell from the bleachers at a very young age, falling apparently being what I did with my father. I must have been about 12 or 13 when he bought me an outfielder's glove and taught me to bat right and left-handed. When I missed the unit on signed numbers, he brought me up to speed. The last thing I remember he taught me was how to drive like a man, and I do. But where in these memories are conversations, moments he asks what I'm thinking or feeling? I guess one shouldn't expect a teacher to act like a father, but I've often wished he could have made just one more exception, at least for his daughter. Laura, this is for Gary. Until I arrive. Masquerading as the infinite hope of the future's unmet contingencies, the past extends out before us like an alluvial fan down an incline on the outer slopes of an extinct volcano, spent with too much expression and gone cold with the snowfall, or the seed pod of an angiosperm bursting forth in the spring with its fate sealed within. All my life, without even knowing it, I have carried inside me the weight of another's thwarted expectations, mapping my journey to ease the burdens of disappointments unceasing. convinced that the ache I could never put down was born of my own search for perfection. What did he long for, my father, when he learned the title soon would be his? Did he have the imagination at the time to wish for a son? Or did that only come later with the birth of my sister and my own maturation? He never said much to me, except for giving instruction in physics and math and behavioral matters, such as the virtue of rectitude or the lesson hard won that being late for dinner was never an option, or on occasion correcting my childish pronunciation, he finding it wrong, it going unspoken, that his word was not to be questioned. His taciturnity having expanded into legendary proportions of silence within our four-person household of native speakers of English, I never gave a great deal of thought as to why, except for the training in various disciplines, our verbal exchanges went through my mother, she who always assured me of his love and his pride in his offspring. Having been warned not to tell him what I had done or been thinking, it came as a shock when one evening, as I talked with my mother of my style of teaching, he glanced up from the paper he had been reading, looked over his half glasses, and proclaimed in a fiat, typical of what passed in his eyes for a complete conversation between father and child, a comment so fleeting I might have missed it had I not been accustomed to heeding his precepts, that I who had seemed to exist only in faulty translation, I who was closer to 50 than 40, I was indeed, in his estimation, a formidable woman and shouldn't be shocked by my student's reaction. I treasure that judgment from a man who made his living evaluating others' intelligence, that being one of the things we professors get paid for. I learned later, however, that each word had been carefully chosen, as one might have expected, from a man who valued precision, since after all my accomplishments, he still at the end wished for a son. What past lurks around the next corner, I wonder, biding its time until I arrive. Freud taught us to think. You gotta laugh now. You gotta promise me you'll laugh. Freud taught us to think that for daughters, the fault lay with our mothers, the distinction between us being crudely achieved, an argument embraced by a battalion of otherwise skeptical women for nearly a decade, who armed with newfound ambitions lay their faults without shame at their mother's immaculate doorsteps, demanding domestic redress, if not reparation. But I'm here to tell you they're wrong, Freud and his women. The fault lay with our fathers. For now that mine's gone, I cannot move on. I had actually hoped years ago, when first I imagined his dying, that it might liberate me from the scornful voice that corrects all my failings. But coincident with his leaving, I have developed a new imperfection, the worst so far I have known, one unlike the others I am helpless to amend or surmount on my own. This defect is prolonging my grieving, driving it deep into my muscles where it keeps me awake at night. For in the same year, I lost both my father and my hair. A grammatical construction that would be amusing, or even a zeugma, if the pain were not indistinguishable. Of the two, losing my hair was the harder and most unexpected, catching me completely off guard, for I had once welcomed the prospect of aging as far as my hair went, seeing my mother's convert into bullion. I wrote my father's obituary and delivered a eulogy. What have I done for my hair? Though most of my friends had never met him, Living out of town as he did and not being reliably charming, many sent cards to acknowledge his passing. But who makes sympathy cards for hair loss? And whoever would send them? Since I am clever at concealing it, and my husband assures me that no one can tell, who even knows that a part of me has gone missing? Yet what I have lost has eaten into the core of my being like a demon I love too well to let go. I cannot recount what bargains I have struck with fate, or those I would still make if only my hair would grow back. If I live to the conventional age for old ladies today, I will have spent exactly 1/3 of my life with neither a father nor a full head of hair. Now, who can ask sympathy for such a comparison? To whom do I turn for true understanding? The expert I consulted, by the way, down at U of M, coolly informed me, with grammatical inexactitude, but speaking ex cathedra, from the airless heights of his famed professional station, when I confessed how hard it was to deal with my loss, and could he give me assurance it wouldn't get worse, it was hard for everyone, presumably including himself, though this went unmentioned, he being the doctor and I but the patient, to find they are losing their hair. Why didn't that comfort me? My hairdresser said in shocked disapproval when I reported the story to her that he should have known better, that highly paid doctor. Didn't he realize that losing my hair was like losing a part of my body, an arm or a leg, and mourning was part of the process of grieving? On another occasion, when I confessed with embarrassment that it hurt worse to lose my hair than my father, a young male friend, as yet with little authority and even less hair than the doctor, remarked with bracing frankness and a slight lift of the shoulders for emphasis that his hair had always meant more to him than his father did. For these remarks, I am grateful. And we'll consult with these two again. But though what they offered far exceeded in insight and informed understanding, the expert's sweeping dismissal of my plea for human compassion, their remarks haven't yet helped the pain go away. Why is it my father I think of when I look in the mirror every day? Okay, one more poem from this collection and then on to the resurrection of Corey. You need it, right? Terror of heights. Sorry. As a child, you'll recognize this person. As a child, I always preferred to pick the grit and dirt myself out of the wounds I acquired. As easily as other girls amass bouquets for their manners and dress. No prom queen, though later appraisals would suggest I might have been had I half tried or even known how to. I thought the route to my daddy's heart lay in the things he liked to do. And above all else, he liked to be entertained. So I learned, among other embellishments, to be witty and quick, tell stories, convulse him with laughter. Though my thoughts ran secret and dark like an underground stream, with him I was the noisy one on the rock face, bright, clever narratives bursting out of me, like water crashing downhill at a pace too swift to be stopped or traversed. So impressed with the velocity and skill of my falling down inclines was my family, no one stopped to consider the moments of black stillness that curled at my feet. Caught in the rock-laden basins filling my head with live water hissing, trapped water purling and gurgling, dragonflies lit on a reed. Photographs that are filed in a tin hat box reveal blonde hair, refusing the maternal order of braids, with which I began each day in a torture of combing and pulling. In the pictures, I appear untethered, hair flying, mouth open, gaze bold and defiant, belying the role of mommy's good girl, to which I was held by bridles stronger than plates. It is only my knees that require no explanation, bloody lips, torn open or scabbed over, the bits of grit from my tumbling down cliffsides and mountains, carefully picked out and placed on the floor by my bed to reduce, if not eliminate, scarring. Though I was loud, I was watchful, and learned young the art of averting a crisis. What makes a father's anger so total, so compelling, so final? Why did the streams, the tadpoles, the turtles, and mayflies all coalesce into the mafic peaks of a rage I found so terrible to contemplate that I would do anything to forestall it? On our hikes in the backcountry, my husband, who knows anger but never ascends into the volcanics of rage, explains the formation of mountains, intrusions, subduction, convergence, and uplift. His voice a soothing flow of geologic reason, sinking us both into the chill depths of deep time, easing my childborn terror of heights. Who carved all those statues, formed all that clay of terrible goddesses with bulging wombs and multiple breasts, giving birth and eating their young, arms raised in destruction, or cradling their offspring, their torsos adorned with poisonous serpents, laurel trees growing out of their limbs? The books never say, though the implication is certain it must have been man, overwhelmed by woman's worldly dominion, life-giving and taking rolled into one, fecund mother of earth and the night sky, who mindlessly commands his submission with the dark rapaciousness of the primordial feminine, until inspired and hardened by the winds of the sun, or so goes the rendition, he plots for her end, when the blistering light of his mind will dispel her tenebrous powers, the new myths he invokes inverting maternal tradition, where bent men do the birthing as well as the killing, and reason is king. Ah, but the books get it wrong. Men didn't craft all those figures of ravening mothers. It was their daughters who shaped the vessels and cauldrons just trying to get out of the cave that entombed them. A jar filled to the neck with red jellied seeds of the pomegranate tree. The custom we share. In order to fully understand one of the lines in here, you need to know, if you look up the word vagina in the dictionary, you'll see as the word it derives from is sheath. For his sword, no doubt. She walks with an uncertain shuffle that marks the gait of those African women who have had their sex excised by a shard of glass in their mother's dutiful hands, or Chinese women who have lotus blossoms for feet, hips swaying with the rhythm men find so enticing they would bind and shear the fungible parts of the next generation, ensuring their daughter's connubial union. But the wound that she carries, making walking so strained, has nothing to do with men. It is that of an incomplete separation, like those plaguing Siamese twins. For I am stuck in the birth canal, married to my mother, half in, half out, head free, arms flailing, bum buried, without the use of my feet. It's hot in here, making me dizzy. But no matter how taxing my efforts to finish the task, the world still remains inverted to me. In my dreams, I run swiftly to the horizon where I clasp the outstretched hands of alien women speaking in mysterious tongues who yet embrace me in full understanding of the custom we share. Awake, I lunge yet again for that cold pair of scissors she's got in her sewing box, lying serenely among the tight coils of bright-colored threads and short-tempered needles. Just one little incision, and I'll finally be free. My umbilicus no longer trapping me in the doubled in-between spot, but a single French knot, a pink rosette on the bridal embroidery I have been weaving, while she treads the machine with her elegant feet that would stitch us together forever in the sheath of her making. Incantations of clay. For my own good, they explain. The women, broken-winged and weeping like killdeer, have kept me silent when I would speak. Sealing the curve of my tongue like a stillbirth in an unmarked jar of preservative, kept on display with the malformed fetal mistakes of frogs and snakes and unfinished freaks of humanity. None willing to serve as midwife or nursemaid to the thoughts I might beget as a singular mother in a time of conformity. But what monsters I might have wrought out of the volcanic depths of my wound had I spoken. Red mouths gaping and shrieking, a bat for every breast, mantles the goddess of Ephesus, pausing only to suckle before resuming their infernal clamor. Avenging furies with leathery wings that darken the sky and swallow the shadows, portending ruin to those who would silence me, deny me a voice from the cave or the cauldron, and when I get hoarse at that poem. The details in this next poem are all correct. They come from a book I've just read, Sarah Blaffer Hurdy's book, Mother Nature. I recommend it to you. It's called In Service to the Species. The demon in the attic, or the angel in the house. We can look to nature for examples of what motherhood entails. The cowbird, who lays her bully egg in a sparrow's crowded nest. A foundling who is raised at the family's expense. The mouse who eats her pups if no male will help her tend them. The Langur monkeys who mate willingly with the strangers who have murdered all their infants. But it takes a simple spider to sacrifice herself sufficiently to meet the expectation the world lays down at any female's feet. This selfless creature lays her ripened eggs and lingers by the nest until the spiderlings emerge. The more they roam about on their spindly busy legs, the more domestic she becomes until metabolism stops altogether. And her body liquefies just enough to feed her grasping children an egg-rich pudding that she had put aside in anticipation of their need. The good mother, even after death, not matricide, but matrophagia, in service to the species. That means eating your mother. Gynophagia means eating a woman. Do with that what you will. A curtain of weeping. Had I been asked, I might have chosen to spring fully armed and ready for combat like Pallas Athena from the head of her father. What a warrior I would have made, battle cries roaring down canyons as swift and turbulent as uncontained water, hissing and thundering my way into legend, tumbling massive boulders as though they were nothing, upending trees and spooking the eagles, thrusting my aegis adorned with snake-headed Medusa into the heavens that recoiled in fright at the sight of a virgin wantonly shouting for war, as my darling crows urged me on, their black-feathered scimitars cutting the wind in a frenzy of anticipation, beaks agape and eyes shining, prime for the carnage I would be wreaking. But alas, no trumpets heralded my coming, and my father's head remained whole. My mother's body opened first to receive me, then loosed a torrent of water when I wanted out. Though I burst forth with a promising wail that echoed 6 months by her telling, I soon learned the virtue of silence, broken only by soothing, placative murmuring, intended to forestall the specter of unforeseen wrath that stalked my days and my dreaming, veiled always in a curtain of weeping. Metempsychosis. Never having had children myself, I've delivered no new diversions to deflect her attention or absorb her affection when I'm around. I think I'll suckle a wolf cub. Wear it next to my breast. Dress it in pink with peekaboo ruffles, shielding the eyes that would give the game away, were she to gaze on them directly. Explain the pup's growls as severe indigestion brought on by the bile in my milk. Its bark as a lasting attack of whooping cough, fearful as I was of the shot to prevent it. Its rapid growth as a consequence of me feeding it sugar to help it sleep. Its smell as that of any baby whose diapers are not changed often enough. Its fearlessness is that of an undisciplined child who has been inadequately supervised. That ought to do it. Keep her busy for the next several years. She'll think me a terrible mother, but at least I will have outwitted the dread role of daughter, cowed by her tears. And where does my sense of humor come from? Why, it comes from my mother. So this last poem is my mother speaking. And this is what she said. She really does have a good sense of humor. Out of habit. Just throw me on the compost when I'm dead and rotten. Let the crows and feral cats take me at their leisure. Poor things, I've run them off enough from the suet and the feeder. It's not so strange what I am asking if you think about it. What strikes me as peculiar is sealing up a corpse with chemicals and hardwood to delay decomposition, as though we all were descendants of the pharaohs, if only for the moment, painted red and linen clad, our viscera in four canopic jars, packed in unguents like our carcass, to survive intact the journey of the dead. Instead of a mortician, I'd rather have the maggots and the beetles get the work. Lord knows they need it. Besides, I like the thought of decaying with the leaves. My clean-picked, desiccated bones, resisting time and deliquescence at a stately pace. No fallen tree or broken branch can ever hope to match. I'll need nothing for my travels. I won't be reading, keeping house, or dining out. Remember, I'm the dinner. So toss my naked body on the compost and sell the rest of my estate. The curious will come to pry, but you can bet they'll stay to buy when they see my life laid out before them in numbered lots like treasures from an excavation. Remember what I've told you, and make sure the auctioneer starts the bidding high enough for all the stuff that's dear. You might not want it, but someone will, as a holy relic or a souvenir. I know I haven't always been what you wanted in a mother, but daughter, promise that you'll grant me this my last request, if only out of habit. Thank you. Well, thanks. Sounds like you like them as much as I do. I'm supposed to answer questions now. I knew this would happen. Let's see, I've already told you where poems come from, right? Everywhere. I think the poems make that pretty evident. I told you to be alert so you don't miss them. My poems, I'll ask the questions, what the hell? I always teach my students that's a hard part. I couldn't hear you. Do I get poems from my students? Yes, I had my 210 class write poetry when I taught that course a couple years ago. We spent quite a bit of time on poetry, remember? And then I taught an honors class, and a student shared some of his poems with me. Yeah. Oh, do I get? No, I get. I didn't understand your question. Yeah, sorry. Do I? No, I don't write about my students. No. 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 Yeah, yeah. I wonder why. Mary Alice.
You mentioned ideas.
Yeah. Because I like to think I am. Who have I influenced? Yeah, and it's kind of a hodgepodge, actually. I thought maybe somebody would ask this question, so I prepared an answer. No, it wasn't. I just guessed what was going to be on the final. Emily Dickinson is an influence on me. And at the other end of the spectrum, James Dickey. His poetry tells a story, very vivid imagery in there. Also, Margaret Atwood's books of poetry tend to tell a story, especially her journals of Susanna Moody. And I'm trying to tell a story, so that's why I mention Atwood and James Dickey. But also, I think all of us women writing right now have been, to one degree or another, influenced by Anne Sexton and Sylvia Plath. Those women sort of gave us permission to talk about a lot of things that I talk about. Yeah. Melissa?
They say that, like Emily Dickinson, that a lot of her writings were not meant for public, and that after she passed away,
I wrote poetry because I can't help myself. I have to. I feel grouchy if I'm not doing it. You know, some people don't get enough sex, they get grouchy. I don't do enough poetry writing, I get grouchy. And which is good. It's good, you know, because it takes practice. You got to keep working at it. So I write just because there's a poem in there. No, I try to visualize this, and you know, you get all these metaphoric images, and it complicates things. But it's like a poem comes to me in its entirety, almost. And I have to sort of unpack all the stuff that's hiding it, so that, you know, so the angle. It's like, you know, cutting a gemstone or something, almost. And so it's the writing that drives me. So in that way, I'm writing for myself, because I had this need to write. I mean, the first thing I ever published was a poem. I published it when I was 10. Not a very good poem. I think I have the only extant copy, and it's going to remain hidden. But I also feel that my ability to write the way I do is a gift. It took me a long time to come to that realization. I thought, I don't know, that I was being sort of a show-off or something. Because I would read poems I had written at a funeral, or read something, a toast at a wedding, that sort of thing. And I realized how much pleasure I was able to give other people. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, yeah, I want all this stuff to be published. I mean, it's pleasure. It hurts, you know? I mean, how many of you, I mean, let's have a show of hands, have ever read a poem about a woman's hair loss before? You know? We don't talk about it. And those of you who know me, which most of the people in this room, you know, fall into that category, know I talk about things that other people won't talk about. So there's sort of an answer. Sort of reformulated your question, I think. Did I do that, or did you do that, John? I'm doing it. I'll dance over here. I can't remember your name.
Kirsten.
Kirsten, that's right.
Do you always write in free verse, or do you use form?
I don't like to call it free verse. Technically, it is free verse. But it's a very carefully constructed free verse. I've labored over it terrifically. So they're echoes of the sounds.
I heard that.
That's all done intentionally.
Oh.
Yeah. I found an email. I was emptying my email account today, and I found one I had written to my husband about 2 months ago. And I said that we tell each other what we're doing during the day. And so I said, I've been hammering away at this poem all day. I think I've beaten a hole in it. And I said, they all came this hard, I'd never get anything published. So yeah, it's all there on purpose. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, this is, writing poetry is a discipline. You know, it really is. It's like playing the piano, which I cannot do. Ed.
I was going to ask you, how much has your poetic abilities, how much has that influenced your teaching style?
Well, I never thought of that. I don't know. Do you think it has?
I don't know. You're often very personal, I guess, in your teaching and in your poetry as well.
Why, thank you. I hadn't realized that.
No, I hadn't.
I spent a year, I'll tell you this secret now, it's been so long. I spent a year as a faculty intern in the office of the provost. Oh, well, you know, we all make mistakes. And I would spend lunchtime writing poetry. That's how I got through the year. And I found when I went back to the English department that I was so much better at writing prose. And I had really improved my writing terrifically. So I think, yes, my prose and my poetry feed each other, but I hadn't thought to include my teaching. I'm glad you think that there is a connection. That pleases me. Someone else? Question, June?
Do you publish more prose?
That's a very good question. I don't know whether I will or not. The last couple of things I've written, I can't get published because they're so weird. yeah, nobody recognizes them. You know, I mean, it's not conventional prose. And so they'll write me back and they'll say, gosh, this is really funny. I'm keeping it and I'm showing it to everybody because I like it so much. But I can't possibly publish it because the board is too stodgy. So... I think it's going to be poetry from now on. I'm old enough. I've written enough prose. I can do this if I want to, I think. I paid my dues. Oh, it was fun paying them. I enjoyed the other. What did you say?
Well, there's an awful lot of weird stuff being published.
I know there is, and that's what ticks me off, that they don't like my weird stuff. I have yet to find someone who likes it and has the proper board to approve it. That's what I need. Any other questions? Anyone has? Dan?
Do you have an idea for a poem you read spontaneously?
I try to write it spontaneously, yeah, because it usually comes to me in the first line. And I write at the computer, which I never thought I would do. I mean, my husband could tell you how I resisted ever even learning to use a computer. No, I had all sorts of reasons I didn't want it, you know. And now I actually compose on the computer. The disadvantage will be to all these, you know, people down the pike, you know, when I'm dead and famous, and they'll want to recreate how I wrote a poem, and they'll only have, you know, 4 drafts. There will have been, you know, maybe 45 drafts. But I'm a really fast typist, and I'm a very fast thinker. And so once I get that first line down, man, I'm off. And I get the whole thing down as best I can. And then I go back and do, you know, the grunt work. You know, that's where it's too easy. That sound isn't right, that sort of thing. I can make it more complex here, more beautiful here, that sort of thing. Any other questions? I don't know your name. Do I write about love? No.
No, no mystery.
No, I don't think there's no mystery in love. I just don't write about it. I don't write about it. It doesn't interest me as a subject of poetry. I'll scalp the copy I've got if someone wants to buy it. No, seriously, you can get it on Amazon.com. I'm giving another poetry reading May 3rd, which is during exam week. It's on a Tuesday at Schuller Books. It's at 7:30. They'll have copies there. There should be copies at the student bookstore across the street from Morrill Hall. It's like, excuse me. I asked them to order copies, and they seem to be pretty interested. You can order it directly from the press online, so you can get a copy of it. And it's $16, which, my God, is almost an order of magnitude cheaper than my other books. Any other questions? Kate? Oh, I've written a couple novels, but those are in my file drawer too, okay? Because it's very hard to break in, without an agent. And again, I write unusual things, and the agents go, I have never seen anything like this before. But then I've written as, you may remember from class, I've written on African-American literature, and science fiction. So these are books that nobody reads, but that I've gotten raises for writing. So you don't get rich from the royalties. You just get rich from the retirement plan. Allie? Oh, I wish I knew. I don't know, because I think you want to do that? Is that it? I got that poem in there about that, right? I shouldn't be surprised at my students' reaction, right? Yeah, I know. Well, he's brilliant. There's no question about it. And he didn't suffer fools gladly. And I've had to fight that. I have. But I don't think it does my students any good to coddle them. I think that probably we expect too much of our parents, but not enough of our students. I know you can learn this stuff. And I know I can explain it. Any other questions? Well, thank you so much for coming. I really appreciate it.